Get ready to expand your horizons and discover great reads. This is Bookbound, a library podcast. Welcome back. I'm Jessica Trotter, and I'm joined at the mic by Cheryl Lindemann and Mari Garza, and we order Kettle's library collection, basically.
Hello.
And like to talk books.
Hello.
Well, welcome to you both. We have quite a range of titles we want to talk about today. We've got some gardening, we've got food, we've got strange fantasy stories, and I think we're just going to jump right in.
Yeah, okay, I've got the first one. This is Mari, and I am reviewing or talking about The Lamplighter by Crystal J. Bell. This is a young adult novel. It is, I got, you know, attracted to it because it's historical fiction, sort of mystery, but definitely by the middle of the book, you see that it is horror. albeit a little bit horror light because this is a young adult novel. The setting is a seaside town in New England. We're going to say maybe the 1850s. I'm not really sure. And shipping is a big part of the economy. There's also wood carving because the wood carving adorns a lot of the ships that bring in goods, and especially whale oil. It was used as fuel during this time in the 1850s. And Temperance is our main character. She's 18 years old, and she's basically the, you know, the lamplighter or the streetlighter, which was a thing back in the day. They would use whale oil to physically light every lamp in the mornings, or I'm sorry, in the dusk time or right before night. And then early in the morning, she would have to go back to finish her shift to put out the lights. So it was a very important job. She is now the head of her family because her father recently passed away under very sad circumstances. And she's really trying to hold on to this job because at the time, women, girls were not allowed to have these kind of utility jobs. These were important, you know, sort of like union jobs, you know, really good jobs. And she's trying to do a really good job. Her sweetheart is out at sea working a ship, you know, to get the whale oil. So she's inherited this job from her father. And, you know, she's trying to make it work for her family because she is basically the head of her family now. She has a little sister and her mom. And this book, I think, did such a wonderful job of creating atmosphere. It's just very gothic-like. You know, I'm thinking sort of like Greenfield Village, you know, you're walking around, you know, maybe this 2 or 3 mile area. There's, you know, a very walkable community. There's green spaces. There's forests. And there's the fog. It rolls in every night, you know, think dusk, you know, maybe 5 or 6 o'clock at night. And it, you know, the descriptions are like it goes up to your shins. And then there's also this history of girls going missing, and not just girls, actually some of the workers from the ships, they also go missing when they're at port. There's a little bit of drama with an older man wanting to marry a, you know, the 16-year-old younger sister, which I think was common at that time and in many communities, maybe still is, where older men marry teenagers. The woodwork is just beautiful and creepy, too, at the same time. I think that as it unfolds, you really understand how interdependent the community was on one another and just sharing things. I really think it was very, very well done. It was kind of presented as a book for, like, if your kid is ready for something past the Goosebumps sort of series, this could be it. And I would say, like, 8th or 9th grade would really enjoy something like this and also be able to consider investigating, you know, whale oil was really a thing. I remember when I learned about that many years ago, I was like, wow, that's kind of interesting. And, you know, it was considered indispensable to bring light to public works.
Yeah, they use the whale for everything.
Yeah, I mean, at least they did that.
And decimated the whale population.
I mean, exactly.
Yes,
I mean,
exactly. Because it was also used for candles and other.
So, kind of going off the kind of gothic feel, and the Northeast. I have a book called The Blackbird Blackbird Oracle by Deborah Harkness, and I, Cheryl at least can attest that this arrived kind of as a surprise. I had kind of maybe put in for a sort of a lottery for the book, thinking I would get an advanced reading copy, and I got a hardcover ready to release book, and I kind of screeched when it was delivered to my desk. So this ahead of release. So this is a continuation of the Discovery of Witches series. So if you're familiar, there's a trilogy. One extra book was made into an AMC series. It was actually really stuck relatively well to the books. So we have, it's not the best place to start in the series, but it's just it is a wonderful series. I would highly suggest checking out, starting from the beginning with The Discovery of Witches. But this one, what I love about this one is that the main character is a witch and Yale professor, history of science, and her husband, a vampire, and geneticist. And Oxford professor. They have, the first three books were their trials. The fourth book was a little bit of a side story about one of his children prior to her. And we're now continuing with Diana and Matthew's story, and they now have 7-year-old twins who are a perfect balance of witch and vampire, each with their own gifts, and very precocious. But one of the really interesting things about this one to me is that these books have been set in France and Europe, in London, Madison in Massachusetts, but now this is a story that's pulling them into Diana's, the one part of her family she hasn't actually ever gotten to know, and that is her father's family, who are from Ipswich. And it's very much, her father was a proctor, as in John Proctor of the Salem Witch Trials. Her mother was a bishop, as in Bridget Bishop, who was the first woman who was hung a witch during the Salem Witch Trials, and John Proctor was as well. Harkness plays so much and so well with that history of that area and with the families that if you've read anything about the Salem Witch Trials, the families that the names that come up in that are the ones that are coming up in this book, the Mathers, Cotton Mather family, all of these, and it's a very interesting, fun way of weaving together her stories, which focus on this balance of witch, human, vampire, and daemon, which is a whole other thing. It's fun. It's a lot of fun. I'm very happy to be back in this. If you have already read the first trilogy, or Time to Convert is the fourth book, this is a really wonderful addition, and there's no question that there's more books coming. If I didn't, I know that the next book is already done, and the third book is being worked on. A third extra book is being worked on. So if you are at all interested in this, in the Discovery of Witches series, I would certainly find this quickly, because it's wonderful. Sounds it's just great. Lots of humor, yeah. But also some serious questions about, balance and light and dark, and finding your own place in the world, and letting your children find their own way, not letting the pressures of the world push them too hard in a direction. So it was very interesting. And, absolutely just, I jumped and I read, that's what I wanted to read.
Yeah, great. Those both sound really good and immersive worlds. Mm-hmm,
very much.
Kind of ties, sort of, not really, but the immersive world ties into
yes.
the book that
well,
I have.
I was going to say, I've got Witch's Gardens in here,
yeah.
too.
Okay, there you go. So we're going to go across the pond to another immersive book. This one actually has a little story on it, too, because I purchased this in England at the British Library Bookshop, and it somewhat coincided with the U.S. release, which doesn't always happen. It was released a few months before the U.S. release of this book. So this book is available now in the United States. And both the United States version and the British version have these really sort of busy, beautiful covers. They look like maybe a poster for a floral exhibition. I would say the English one, the United States one, is even busier, rather. And it kind of fits the book because it's beautiful and, like, those posters are almost, I don't know, kind of gaudy, too. And that really fits sort of the theme of the book because there's a lot going on here. So this is called The Garden Against Time, In Search of a Common Paradise by Olivia Lang. Olivia Lang is an author. She's had fiction, but she's really well known for cultural criticism, essays about society, about art. And this is one of those garden books where I love garden books. And you give me a book about, mm-hmm. you know, picture garden book, instructional, or a story. I would love to read how I made this garden. How did it happen? And you think that's what this is going to be. And on the one hand, it is. But it's also a deep dive into gardens as a concept. The concept of Eden, paradise, utopia, and looking at the darker legacies in gardens of colonialism, of slavery, funding garden, the funds to build these huge gardens, even in England. So plantations in the U.S. funding these huge English estates. It's a big thing over there. But also about trying to look for that idea of utopia. So there are a lot of idealists in this book. Each chapter is a little profile of someone in history. And it was fascinating. I learned a ton. You know, Milton from Paradise Lost, she talks a lot about him and his idealism, his activism during the English Civil War, his very dangerous activism. William Morris, the designer, she talks about him quite a bit in the book, and that's really fascinating. She talks about Derek Jarman, the filmmaker, and his garden at Dungeness, and his activism and his search for a safe space as a queer man and for beauty in his garden. So it's really rich. It's not just, I made this garden, but it's also, I made this garden.
Right.
So she marries late in life to a man who isn't a writer in England, and they do have this huge Sussex estate with this tumble-down garden, which was a big garden by a very famous designer, but it's totally in shambles. So the book is also her putting together, piecing back this garden, trying to figure out who the garden designer was, what was his story, meeting people who knew him, looking through books about the old pictures of the garden, these really fancy parties that were there. And what I really like is she also deals with, this is a very privileged garden and a privileged place, and she deals with that directly, whereas a lot of garden writing, traditional garden writing, really doesn't, I would say. She says things like, beauty is not a virtue that floats free of cost. Mm-hmm. And I really liked that, too. And another quote from the book that I thought was really stood out to me was, though I often felt overwhelmed or out of my depth when making the garden, I also knew that to be able to make something on your own terms is among the greatest luxuries, though it should be a universal right. So she addresses mm-hmm. that piece of it too. Mm-hmm. I absolutely love this book. I can't recommend it enough for someone who loves essays and who loves garden writing, who loves nature, is concerned about how gardens can help us sort of heal what's going on with our planet right now. And this means if you have a balcony with a pot on it, if you have a backyard, it doesn't have to be these big giant palatial gardens like in England. It's, you know, what we all can do piecing together and looking at gardening as a new, in a new way, ultimately, at the end of the book. So highly recommend this one.
That kind of reminds me of Soil.
Yes, definitely.
Very much by Dungy.
Yes, and exactly. It fits into that narrative and that discussion that's really going on about who is gardening for.
Right.
What is the legacy of it? Yeah, it was really phenomenal. Cattle's libraries we have a great garden collection. We have so many different types of books and books like this that are filling it out in a different way. Mm-hmm. And another topic that's really popular is wild foraging.
Oh, yeah.
We've noticed it when we do our collection visits. Every collection has medicinal plants, wild foraging. It's hot, it's popular, and finding good books is kind of hard. So I actually have a guest today, somebody who is integral to our podcast, who basically makes it happen behind the scenes, Cassidy Gould, our social media coordinator at Cattle. And she's going to talk about a book on this topic that she really loved recently.
Woohoo!
Hi.
Welcome.
It's weird being on the podcast after being behind it so many times. But great to be here. Thank you. So the book that I checked out and really enjoyed was Sam Thayer's Field Guide to Edible Wild Plants of Eastern and Central North America. And I actually requested this book from the library as soon as I realized it had been published, because this is a forager that I follow on TikTok. And I, before putting my own money into the book, essentially, I wanted to make sure he actually knew what he was talking about.
Which is a good way of doing it.
Yeah. Don't believe everything you see on the internet, kids. That's everything with a grain of salt. But so, you know, I'm not an expert on books or plants or the environment or the body, but I am here recommending a book about foraging, because for all the things that I'm not, one thing that I am is a very thorough reader, with a very strong passion for environmental causes. So for all the books that I've read on foraging, many good, many bad, very bad. this title has been by far the most thorough, well-organized, well-researched, and responsibly accessible book that I've read on the topic. And, you know, when I was first, like, putting together my spiel for this book, I wanted to say that it was easy to read, and that probably is true for, like, actual plant experts, but I'm not one of those plant experts. So there were a lot of terms that I had to learn and still have to learn. So that's why I said responsibly accessible instead, because he doesn't dumb down the descriptions so much that there's room for any type of dangerous misinterpretation, which I've seen with some foraging books. Mm-hmm. But he standardizes his descriptions and information, provides an illustrated glossary for technical terms, like arrows and everything. It's fantastic. And even guides for, like, how to use his guides. What mm-hmm. does he consider edible, poisonous? Flipping through the book right now, which you can't see on the podcast. And it's just... it's just incredibly thorough. I've already used it to identify pin cherries in my neighborhood. That has been really cool. And honestly, that one was really, really fun, because I spent like 10 minutes trying to decide. I'm like, okay, is this one of these types of cherries? And I narrowed it down between a sweet cherry and a pin cherry, and literally one like little tiny note. For all intents and purposes, they look very, very similar, at least to me and in the descriptions. And there was one little note that said that the pin cherries, the new bark, if you scratched it, it smelled like almonds.
Okay.
And that's how I ended up identifying it was pin cherries so over cool. sweet cherries, which mm-hmm. tells me when I can go back and go forage for those, because wow. they have mm-hmm. slightly different seasons.
Mm-hmm.
And interests. I guess sweet cherries are hard to come by because the birds come by them first. Which is fair, like, yeah. you know, when you're foraging, and that's something else that he really touches on in the book, is foragers are essentially, like, the people who are caring about the environment, because they are relying on it. They're the one, you know, you are gaining this knowledge, this very important knowledge, and he recognizes that in... like a section on gratitude in the beginning, he says, I was raised on land ceded to the United States under the unjust circumstances, or under unjust circumstances by the Menominee and Chippewa nations. I'm humbled by the privilege of having my feet upon these lands and these waters in my blood. The knowledge of these and other original peoples of North America has been the single most important source of information for the food uses listed in this book. And I'm deeply grateful for that knowledge.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
And awesome. He also has other great quotes. And I mean, that's just something that is really important to recognize. And he recognizes that a lot of, like, his book covers over 700 plants. And he's like, this probably isn't even like the tip of the iceberg, because right. so much information has been lost over the years due right. to those unjust circumstances. And at the very back of the book, it does cover some confusing, poisonous plants, but he heavily encourages that you don't, like, he says, if you're ruling something out to decide what something is, you don't know what it is, and you shouldn't be eating it. Like, mm-hmm. responsibility is very important. Mm-hmm. One of his quotes is, every year some trigger happy fool shoots a man thinking he's a deer. Don't be the botanical equivalent.
Right. Mm. Yeah. Right.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I highly, highly recommend this book. Cannot recommend it enough. Actually went out and bought my own copy and have been very happily finding a lot of things with it.
Very cool.
That's awesome. Thank you so much for bringing this. I feel like these books are particularly, they're tricky for me. I purchase those as a nonfiction selector, and I'm always a little bit leery when I'm buying them because I think, you know, I want to know what are the credentials of this author. And this one, you talked about it, I felt really good about it. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, and he shares his credentials and shares, like, at the beginning, too. He's like, I am taking responsibility for, like, this is my page. My legal team is nervous about me writing this, but it's important. I'm taking responsibility for what I write in this page. You take responsibility for what you do with this book.
Right. Yeah.
And how you're reading it. So.
That's awesome.
Yeah, absolutely. There's some.
Very cool.
Very mm-hmm. cool. Thank you so much.
And thank you for stepping on this side of the microphone.
Yeah.
Yeah. She's always here.
I was just going to say the same
always,
thing.
Always
she's
here.
Actually always here. She rushes.
I'm lurking in the shadows. Okay, well, thanks for having me.
Thank you.
I've got the next book. This is Maddie, and I'm reviewing an informational or nonfiction picture book called Dive, The Story of Breathing Underwater by Chris Gull. This was just incredibly fascinating. It is a book that kind of covers the history of the diving, I don't know, industry or really just diving in general. Did you know that, you know, the Earth is made up of over 2/3 oceans, right? And yet only 5% of those oceans have really been explored. And that is simply because there's so much of it and the human body cannot go down as far as we think we can. This is a really excellent book in that it investigates the history of diving and especially the apparatuses or the many different types of devices that have been developed to help the human body go down and explore life underwater. Gull, who is both the author and the illustrator, does an amazing job of just creating a book that is very accessible for children. You learn about what happens to your body when you go down. He refers to things as the bends, or what is called decompression sickness. And it's basically, you know, when someone has been breathing compressed air for a long time, as it slowly decreases, you just like have a rush of, I think it's nitrogen, I could be wrong, but something that goes into your blood system that is just too quick, too much, and it eventually causes you to have these like really painful episodes once you come up. But he also just, you know, discusses the diving bell, this something called the bathysphere. This object that you like put yourself into, and I know I've seen these images, you know, in movies and in books, but to hear about the history of it, and like, this is like made of something really, really strong. And, you know, for a bit, it can help you to explore and to see outside the little window. But it was just a really, really good book. And they have a really excellent, what I might call the resource guide or glossary of terms, back matter, some people call it. One of the fun facts, coconuts are more dangerous than sharks. Very good to know, considering we've had some shark stories in the news lately. Falling coconuts kill an average of 150 people a year. Sharks kill an average of 10 people a year. So, anyway, this is the story of Breathing Underwater Dive by Chris Gull.
When we were talking about this yesterday, it immediately brought to mind a website that I had seen years ago.
Yes, the website.
Called The Deep Sea by Neil Dotfun. It's actually Neil Agarwal, It's just a really neat interactive website that you scroll down the depths of the sea, and it talks about some of these things and some of the history of how far people have gotten, and
wow.
You know, when they actually managed to hit Challenger Deep. And with images of the things that can live at each of these levels.
That is really cool.
It's fascinating. It's kind of outrageously creepy. Yeah. Sometimes
some of
when
the
you
sea
see
life
this.
We would never see yeah. if it we did not go into the water. Go down.
Yeah. So no, that was. I'll put the link in the show notes. But it just immediately came to mind when she started talking about this book.
So cool. Sounds great.
So my next book is kind of different than everything. So I just finished Briefly Perfectly Human by Eloa Arthur. This explores, of all things, end-of-life planning, but also living in general, through the experiences of the U.S.'s foremost death doula. Eloa, it's part memoir about her life. She is a recovering lawyer. She is the children of Ghanaian immigrants, as in a coup happened. Her father went to prison. Her family, they eventually managed to get everybody out of the country. But as a result, her parents became missionaries, basically. He had a bit of a jail conversion. And that's the sort of life that they traveled as when she was a child. She spent a fair amount of time in the United States. As the children of African immigrants, that, you know, the options are kind of law or medical. She went the law route. It was really not for her, and she was too stubborn to admit that for a very long time, to the detriment of her health. But I mean, it's sort of like she's so down to earth and so interesting to listen to. And things, it's sort of a feel that things happen the way they're supposed to happen in many ways. She would prioritize travel in her time away from work. And kind of one of the first incidences that sort of led her to her life as a death doula was meeting somebody. She was in Cuba, just sort of backpacking it, and met somebody on a bus. Who has been traveling, a German woman who'd been traveling kind of as a result of receiving a terminal, news of a terminal illness. And they met on the bus, they ended up staying together and talking and just talking about the woman's life going forward and what may have been missing from her life and what she wants to do with the time left and that sort of thing. And it was sort of a first step that it wasn't an immediate thing, but it was a first step for Eloa in terms of working her way into the path that she's now on. And it's really interesting because she gives examples, again, it's part memoir, but it's also, she's giving examples of different people's ends of life or reasons that they would come to a death doula. And it really, really pushes people to think about death, but also think about living. Really being in the moment, thinking about what are the things that you actually, you know, if it was tomorrow, if it was in the next month, if it was in a year, you don't really know what you're promised. There's no promise in that sense. So, you know, getting your head around the fact that everybody dies, that's just all there is to it. What are the things that you want to do in that time? She's created a business called Going With Grace. They offer life services, but they also do doula training. I was surprised, kind of looking at the website, she also has a course exploring mortality, partnering with Caitlin Doty, who had a very famous book, From Here to Eternity, a few years ago. It's just fascinating. It does make you think. She gives some questions that, you know, that's worth just sort of ruminating on and thinking about what's important to you. You know, the big ones are, who have you loved, who has loved you, but those types of things. What do you want out of your life? What things are manageable? What things, can you let go of? She has a really fabulous TED Talk, and I'm going to put that one in the show notes too. So cool. It's just really interesting.
Yeah, that sounds great. It seems like one of the books of the year in some ways.
I think so. I think so.
That sounds really interesting. And I did find a link to my next book from your book because the author of this book was a lawyer. Her father was a Jamaican immigrant, and she was really encouraged to become a lawyer, and she did. And she worked in environmental causes, so she tried to zhuzh her love of plants into it. But this is called Garden Wonderland, Creating Life-Changing Outdoor Spaces for Beauty, Harvest, Meaning, and Joy by Leslie Bennett and Julie Chai. And Leslie Bennett ended up leaving the legal profession. She fell in love with her garden and wanted to do that. She became a garden designer, the owner of Pine House Edible Gardens. She, I believe, has been profiled in some of the other books I brought to the podcast, some of those compilations where they're multi, multiple entries of people and gardens. And we buy a lot of these books, and they're lovely. They're eye candy. They're often, you know, pretty fancy gardens. But what I loved about this one is it's 19 gardens, including her own, and they're all extremely unique. They're very diverse. They feature a bunch of people who are gardening for different reasons. And that's sort of the heart of the book. It's like, what is, kind of ties into your book. What is your thing? What are you living for? What is important to you? Is it medicinal plants? Is it beauty? Is it connectedness with neighbors? Is it beautifying a space in a part of a city where there's a lot of crime and a lot of anguish around you? You know, what's your reason? And I really love this book because it talks to the reader about if you're going to have a garden, why? What do you want out of it? What do you want a space to eat? Do you want a space for beauty? Do you want to make your own tea? You know, whatever it is, she kind of helps the reader walk through that. Mm-hmm. So I thought this was really beautiful and notable and just stood out. A couple of the ideas that really jumped out at me is that she says that gardens are all about connection to plants, connection to the people that you might bring into that space, that connection to the earth, community, again, possibly, you know, having tomatoes and giving them to your neighbor, if it could be that simple, or a lot deeper, like a community garden, belonging, which is something that our culture is really looking for, but also belonging to perhaps cultural heritage, and that fits into this too, or foods from, your grandparents' cultural heritage, that sort of thing. And also just a groundedness that comes out of gardening. So Garden Wonderland, I really recommend this one. So we're going to take a little break, and not a break, but a little segment about food. And gardening can tie into that, some of the topics we've talked about today. I think we've talked about food a lot on the podcast in the past. We even had a whole food podcast, at least one in the past, about food books. But last month on Cattle's Facebook page, followers were asked to share their favorite food-related reads. And there were enough responses that I'm going to list them all here. The fiction responses were Love and Saffron, Lessons in Chemistry, Arsenic and Adobo, several books by J. Ryan Stradel, including The Kitchens of the Great Midwest, The Lager Queen of Minnesota, Saturday Night at the Lakeside Supper Club, Delicious by Ruth Reichel, and then we're going to Breakfast of Champions, Naked Lunch, Consider the Lobster, which should be in the nonfiction section. Black Cake, Chocolat, Fried Green Tomatoes at the Whistle Stop Cafe, and for some other nonfiction title, or for nonfiction titles, Everything I Learned in a Chinese Restaurant from last year, Crying in H Mart, which is still continually checking out, A Spoonful of Promises, Stories and Recipes from a Well-Tempered Table, which sounds lovely, and the uniquely titled Come Ashore and We Will Kill You and Eat You, a New Zealand story, which I have checked out several times and not read, and it is a memoir. It's a relationship story between a woman who marries a man of Maori descent. So just a really fascinating list of titles. Yep. And we talked a little bit when we were planning for this podcast about our own favorite food titles. There were so many, it was hard to settle on some, but two that really stand out, and I think I've at least talked about one of them on the podcast before, are Comfort Me with Apples by Ruth Reichel. It's the second of her memoirs. It's, in a way, she's a little older than a coming-of-age story, but she's sort of in her 20s, 30s, living in a Berkeley commune when it starts, and it's just about the sort of really rocky period of her life where she emerges, the food critic and writer that she is now. And then Lucy Knaisley's French Milk, which is a graphic novel. I've talked about that before here. Mm-hmm. Those still are with me. You know, it's those books that stick with you. You don't really exactly know why, but those have stayed with me. How about you two?
David Chang's, I'm going to blank.
Some Epitaph for a Peach?
Eat a Peach,
yeah.
I've read a lot of food writing books. For somebody who is not a wonderful cook, I've read a lot of food writing books. So, I mean, like, probably starting with Heat, Bluford's Heat.
Yeah. So. To say that I have a favorite would be kind of difficult, I guess. I mean, there's a board book series, which I know is not super great nonfiction. Cook in a Book is the name of the series, I think. And, you know, there's a pancakes one, there's a pizza one, there's a taco one,
and that
I
brings
think.
To mind the graphic novel series, is the Let's Make. So yes. Let's Make Ramen, Let's
yes.
Make Dumplings.
There's just so many.
There's a lot.
Yeah. I really like reading about history of foods and, like, how they become famous. The one I brought to the podcast today, it's called Tasty, A History of Yummy Experiments. And it's actually a graphic novel, nonfiction book by Victoria Grace Elliott. She has another one on desserts, too. That one is called Yummy. But she basically presents, like, these four characters who are kind of, like, sort of anime characters. And they, you know, they each play their own role in the book. But she has this really wonderful chapter on pickling. And just, you know, there's either salting or there's brining. And, you know, what is it that is happening when you're cucumber is turning into a pickle? It's really fascinating, and you learn a lot about like so many cultures. This pickling is from all over the world, right? So many different ways to approach it. I have a lot of family in Dearborn, so I go back there when I go into the grocery stores. I'm always fascinated by all the things that can be pickled. I mean, I've never had pickled artichokes, and yet they just have super or turnips, just like amazing foods. So yeah, I would recommend Tasty, A History of Yummy Experiments by Victoria Grace Elliott.
Okay, looks fun.
All right, my last book is actually food related too. It is The Nameless Restaurant by Dao Wang. I came across this because it showed up on a list of cozy fantasy titles. It's a fun novella. What I found is it's actually kind of Wong is revisiting a setting, not the restaurant, but a world that he's created in another trilogy, which I think I might track down, because it's just sort of fun, thoughtful writing. This one, The Nameless Restaurant, takes place. It's a sort of a slice of life approach to a restaurant business. However, it is a very fantasy setting. That's not the right word. Fantasy infused. It takes place in a hole-in-the-wall restaurant that only some people can find in Toronto. It combines kind of the there's kind of a subset of manga that is literally walking you through recipes, but also sort of a little bit of a storyline among the characters along the side. So, like, What Did You Eat Today is a good example of that, but it actually happens in Way of the House Husband, too, and other series that I've come across. But it's both that, because you've got the owner cooking in the kitchen and thinking through very clearly, you know, the steps in making the perfect golden fried rice. But you also have the people in the front of house who are like magic users. There's a dwarf in the beginning. There's a djinn who walks in, and she's brash, and an old friend he isn't thrilled to see you coming through his door, and she's like, "You're feeding us." She has an apprentice. And who's trying to be nice where she's just being, but he feeds them both, and he also knows that her coming in is just sort of trouble. It's just going to be drama, and they come for lunch and they're going to come back for dinner, and so you then end up going to, you know, him creating the foods and then dinner service happening, and then within dinner service there's drama, but still it's relatively low stakes fantasy. It's entirely set in the restaurant. You get a lot of wonderful sounding food. In this particular one, it's all the the menu is new every day, and he's trying to perfect things that he's worked on, you know, in the past. Or he's trying to come up with, like, the perfect Malaysian desserts, the way they were introduced to him. He's not quite there yet for one reason or another. But it's him trying different things. And you find out, of course, as things go along, that he is also a djinn. The restaurant has wards on it and all this sort of thing. It's just a fun, easy, light read with just a little bit of drama to kind of figure out to keep you interested, but also all that interesting, really yummy food as part of it. So I'm going to keep reading. There is one more after this. I think it's called Chaotic Aperitif, and then another one coming out in the new year. So.
For some reason, it reminds me of Legends and Lattes, but I didn't read that. But something about the tone or the feeling.
And that's what it was. I was looking up a list of, you know, more books like that cozy fantasy in Legends and Lattes, and this came up as something to try.
Cool.
I'm thinking of a picture book that I just read called Boys Don't Fry. It's amazing. it's kind of centered around Malaysian cuisine and holidays, you know, and, you know, the stereotypes that we have of our aunties and and, you know, how boys don't do this and but, you know, everyone can cook, right?
Oh, cool.
Right.
That sounds great. Well, I have the last books here, some food tie for this one for sure. The title is called Dispersals on Plants, Borders, and Belonging, and it's by Jessica J. Lee, and she is a British-Canadian-Taiwanese author and environmental historian, and she's been based out of Canada, based out of London, and now lives in Berlin, and she's lived in many of those places in and out in her life, a real story of personal migration. And diaspora and her family. Her mother is Taiwanese. And this is one of those books that's a little hard to sum up really easy, but it's basically a series of essays. And she plays a lot with form in the essays, which is kind of fun. It's not the same form through each one. And I think that's unique and not something I see that often. But the essays are about plants and about migration and about plants that we think of as native to a place and where they actually came from, and like cherry blossoms or tea. We talked about tea on here before, but she gets into all of that about the colonial legacy of many of these plants, but about the sort of ownership that people have of the plants when in reality they were from someplace very non-native, and about those words. So native, invasive species, alien species,
right?
And about that whole lexicon and how it can be very problematic, how it's been called out that way, and how even the concept sometimes, and I personally am a lover of native plants, but even how there is some dialogue in that community just about really nailing down what is native, what isn't, this sort of thing. And so it's really rich and interesting. Each chapter is a different food item, and there's a little bit of personal story woven through, especially the last essay. It's sort of a letter to her daughter, a newborn daughter. Oranges are featured, really great memories of eating citrus, and these, it's just very evocative. Probably my favorite chapter is about soy, and she remembers the soy sauce of her grandmother that was handmade, and she has this dream. She wants to get to a place in her life where she's in a home where she can make the soy sauce, and she does. And it's that painstaking, really painstaking, long process of making homemade soy sauce, and she talks about that. So it's very rich. There's a lot going on in here, a lot of sort of pushing concepts to their edges, which I really enjoy in a book. And this would be really great for even lovers of Braiding Sweetgrass, Robin Wall Kimmerer, just talking about plants and their journeys and native and non-native, that sort of thing. Anybody who really likes essays, who likes personal stories of people who've migrated or stories of migration. So just a really excellent book. Also purchased in England and published here, and with a different cover, which is super fun. I enjoy looking at those different covers, but just great. And she has a few other books that are published in the United States as well. And then briefly, I have A Garden Called Home, which is a picture book that Madi purchased for the library by Jessica J. Lee and illustrated by Elaine Chen. And this is a picture book story about a child, I believe, living in Canada. Her mother just does not like the winters in particular, and just it's not quite home for her. You know, they have a nice family life, but she's bundled up in the winter staring out the window. She tends to her houseplants. And the young girl takes a trip with her mother then to Taiwan and sees what her mother is missing, what her mother loves so much about Taiwan, especially the plants. And then they come back, and the child goes to the library and researches and learns about the plants of Canada, takes her mom on this beautiful hike and says, hey, look at this. You know, this is where we live. These are the plants, and this is what these plants are doing for this landscape. And at the end, they plant a garden together that combines these Taiwanese plants and the plants that are from...
That's sweet.
Yeah, that sort of upper territories, I guess you would say, landscape. So yeah, just a really wonderful story, again, that sort of ties into this in some ways, but for children, about place and really about what is home. Mm-hmm. So, neat.
Very cool. Neat. All right. Thank you all for joining us, and enjoy your reading journeys.